Now, by the middle of the 16th century, Protestantism had reached the height of its influence and the height of its territorial spread. By 1555, which is a good date for you to remember, by 1555, Lutheranism was recognized in the empire and Calvin was firmly established in Geneva. But if you look at things half a century later, by 1600, the Protestant tide had been rolled back. Austria and Poland had been reconquered to the Catholic faith. A series of spectacular conversions to Catholicism almost shook Europe. The age of the religious wars, which lies between 1555 and 1600, shows that the Catholic Church had not been sitting idly by. When Luther had visited Rome around 1510, he had been shocked by the Renaissance papacy. But only 10 years after Luther's visit, a terrible punishment, as people saw it, descended upon the city of Rome. In 1526, the mutinous troops of Emperor Charles V, troops which were mercenaries, but largely Lutheran mercenaries, sacked the city of Rome in order to, as they hadn't got their pay, in order to get loot. This sack of Rome in 1527 was one of the worst of that kind of sacks which had happened in Europe. As one captain wrote, "On the 6th of May we took Rome, having killed 6,000 men, looted the whole city, took all we could find in churches and above ground, and burned a goodly part of the town." It was indeed a rich plunder. All the troops joined in blasphemous rites, not only German Lutheran, but Spanish as well. The sack lasted 8 days, and the population of Rome, as far as we know, declined from some 90,000 to some 40,000 people. It was, therefore, a singular orgy of murder and, from the church's point of view, of blasphemy as well. Now, it is usually from 1527 that the Catholic Reformation is dated, but wrongly so. For the Catholic Reformation had started before that, long before that. There were people who wanted to reform the church. Erasmus, for one. The Christian humanists. But this urge for reform did get an institutionalized form. Throughout the north of Europe and even in Rome, the pious, who were disgusted with the state of the church, founded what they called brotherhoods. Brotherhoods, that is, circles, if you like, communities, but technically they're called brotherhoods for prayer, for charitable work, for all those things which the church apparently was neglecting. These brotherhoods were called eventually oratories, from the Latin orare, or pray. They were called oratories, and you have read about the most famous of them, the Oratory of the Divine Love in Rome, which was founded in 1517, the same year in which Luther posted his famous thesis. These oratories were unions of laymen and priests. They were mixed of laymen and priests to fill the kind of job which they thought the church was not doing and had lost contact with. Indeed, especially the Rome Oratory gathered around it some influential men in the church, men who believed in faith, frequent confessions and charity, who de-emphasized works, who emphasized scripture rather than church tradition. These men were really Christian humanists. And it is these men around the oratories who first tried to mediate the quarrel between Luther and the church, to restore the unity of Latin Christendom, to mediate the dispute, which was something that lay in the very nature of the moderation and rationalism of the Christian humanists, which I've discussed with you before. The result was, in 1540, the famous Diet of Regensburg, and again I'm going over it fast, just this background for you will read about it. The Diet of Regensburg, at which Melanchthon appeared for Luther, Calvin appeared, and the cardinals associated with the divine oratory of divine love appealed as well. Typically enough, Calvin was hostile from the beginning, but it seemed that this summit conference was destined for success for quite a long time, for both the Catholic Church and the Lutherans, at any rate, united on the importance of justification of faith, on the downgrading of works, which was an important point, but they could not unite on the role of saints, on the role of the papacy, and of course on the whole role of the clergy, that they could not compromise. So in the end it failed, and it is that failure which will determine to a large degree the future of the Catholic Reformation. For there had always been hardliners, as we would call them, in the Catholic Church, who believed that you could not mediate this dispute. The way to deal with it was to deal with it at once, as an heresy, to extirpate it. These men based themselves on Spain, and were by and large what we might call the Spanish wing of the Church. For Spain had, of course, driven out its heretics by that time, to come back. It has instituted the Inquisition. It believed in the purity of faith and the purity of race. It is therefore on Spain, with its long crusading tradition against the Muslims, its expelling of the Jews in 1492, its fervor of faith, that the hardliners in the Church based themselves on. But they had what we would call a windfall. For in the midst of Italy, Protestantism made inroads. One of the heads of one of the most important religious orders converted to Calvinism. And that was an alarm signal. An alarm signal that this heresy was indeed penetrating to the very center of the Church. The Catholic Reformation, therefore, turned in another direction. It based itself on the strictness of the religious orders in Spain, on the fervor of Spanish orthodoxy. It began to reject the humanism of the oratories, the humanism of the Netherlands, for which Charles V, after all, stood, the humanism of the Netherlands. It stressed religious discipline. In 1542, the Inquisition was reorganized as the Papal Inquisition, with its center in Rome. But above all, at the same time, the same date, again conveniently arranged for survey courses, in 1540, the same date as the Diet of Regensburg failed, the Jesuit order was recognized by the papacy. And the Jesuit order, to which we must devote the majority of today's lecture, was, after all, to be the instrument of the Catholic Reformation. Now the Jesuit order founded itself again on Spain. Ignatius of Loyola was a Spaniard. The second commander of the order, Leinetz, was a Spaniard as well. It, in a way, founded itself on Spain. And it founded itself on the kind of medieval crusading tradition which was popular in Spain, for Spain had waged this 200-year war against the Muslim, or more, against the Muslim. Loyola's first effort was to go on a crusade to liberate the Holy Land. That was his first effort, to liberate the Holy Land. And only when this came to be impractical did he think of the heretics in Europe as well. Moreover, Loyola was a former army officer, so that the Jesuits, as you know, were organized according to military organization. But because they were a small elite, military organization was firmed, was reinforced by a kind of mysticism popular in Spain, again from Spain. Spain, the country of the great mystics, to which I shall come in a minute, Saint Teresa, Saint John of the Cross, the great mystics of Spain, by a kind of mysticism, an organized kind of mysticism, which became the famous spiritual exercises. The spiritual exercises which were in effect exercises in mysticism, but really exercises in training the will to obedience, in training the will to contemplation of saving the church from heresy. They were, the Spanish mysticism, disciplined. The result you have in your source book excellently expressed in the letter by Parsons, one of the most famous English Jesuit. The kind of fervor that you have reflected in Parsons' letter in your source book is what was produced by these spiritual exercises. The Jesuits were shock troops, not an army. But the spiritual exercises did not mean spiritual intransigence. That is very important for what I have to say in a minute. The spiritual exercises were a mysticism which directed you to contemplate salvation and salvation through the church. They were not dogmatic, and many people took them who never became Jesuits at all. Many people took them who never became Jesuits. Many humanists, in the end, even took them. They must not be confused, as they often have been, with spiritual intransigence, or you will not really get what the Jesuits were all about. On the whole, the Jesuits concentrated on four ways to recapture souls. First, and not surprising, an emphasis on preaching, much neglected. They wanted to be friars. You remember I told you what the friars were. They were a disciplined order of friars, but they concentrated on preaching. Secondly, they concentrated on teaching, with very important results. That is how they reconquered Poland. The Jesuit schools were the best schools in Poland, so that even the Protestants sent their children to these schools. Thirdly, confessors to the powerful and diplomats. That is to say, to penetrate the centers of power, because they all knew how important the humanist advisors had been to the prince and kings, and how indecisive they had been, and so they concentrate on taking the place of humanist advisors. This by becoming father confessors or by diplomacy. And fourthly, and this sums it all up, an appeal to the senses. And about this appeal, I must say much more. This appeal to the senses then must occupy it, for it is of the greatest importance. Loyola's own view of religion was this. Loyola believed, and here again Spanish mysticism is of some importance. Loyola believed that God can be found everywhere, in the senses and in reason. And for that belief, he had been indicted by the Inquisition in Spain. For that belief, Loyola himself had come into collision with the Spanish Inquisition, because he believed in the senses as well as in reason. And as a result of that belief, the Jesuits believed in the use of psychological means to make religion meaningful to the people. After all, the spiritual exercises are a kind of psychological training, if you like, training of the will, but also of the senses. For the spiritual exercises, with their weekly units, where the soul passes through the terror of hell, the passion of Christ, the splendor of heaven, was a kind of psychological training. But above all, Loyola believed in this, of using art for that purpose. Art in several ways, to express religious feeling. And what that meant was, to use art to make religious passion clear to the people. This became especially important in the Jesuit street theater. That is, the Jesuits went around and on street corners performed plays, plays which were, of course, showed how important the church was in salvation. In these plays, facial expressions had to match directly inward experience. The martyred face of Christ in the Passion, the calm face of Christ in the resurrection. What it meant, of course, was an emphasis on emotion, which became, of course, exaggerated. As one poet put it, poetry's goal should be wonder, amazement, and stupefaction. It is that sort of thing that it induced, this use of art for that purpose. Wonder, amazement, and stupefaction. It led to exaggeration. And it led to exaggeration in representation, which became, from the Jesuits, radiating out, extremely popular. Above all, they stressed Christ's passion and Christ's resurrection, but again they were apt to stress the fear of death, and the fear of death was combined with the glory of making contact with Christ and God, the glory of mysticism, the glory of ecstasy. And from that you get many paintings, some of you whom you might know, El Greco paintings and other, of saints in ecstasy. One of the chief ones, for example, is St. Francis and the skull. St. Francis of Assisi in ecstasy. He has made contact with God and the divine. But in front of him lying a skull to remind people of the inevitability of death, of the inevitability, therefore, of the afterlife. It led, of course, to great exaggeration of expression. It led to a kind of wallowing in that sort of exaggeration. It led to flagellation and matters of that sort. But the Jesuits also used art, for example, to indoctrinate their disciples, their novices. The rectory of the monastery. Where the novices trained was painted out with gruesome scenes of torture, so that while they are training, the novices should become used to the fate which awaited them in Protestant countries, and they should be constantly surrounded by these scenes of torture, all the tortures there are. You can still see that if you're ever in Rome. Most people don't even know it still exists. It does. In a church in Rome called San Stefano Rotondo, which you can, it's a little difficult to get into, but you may succeed. And if you come into the church, because it was used as a church, but it was the rectory for the Jesuit novices, you will find in the hall, around the whole walls, and I counted them once, because I'm rather interested in this, 55 different ways of torture of the 16th century, all represented. It is certainly one thing to see in Rome if you ever get there. Now, why am I telling you all this? For two reasons. First of all, it shows you a way in which the Jesuit proceeded. This is quite true. But it also shows you, secondly, that a new style, closely connected to popular piety, was being furthered. A style which goes back to the loosening off of Renaissance forms. It is not a style invented by the Jesuits, but it is a style which they adopted. A style which became universal. It's the first really universal art style we have. And a style which will go under the name of the Baroque. Baroque, the name comes from a curlicue. Barocca in Italian is a curlicue, because it is a very involuted kind of style. This kind of style, and you'll be shown pictures of it in your sections, this kind of style did not go in for cathedrals in the Middle Ages. The emphasis was on senses. The emphasis was on the Jesuit preoccupation with the drama and the theater. Lightning was important, no stained glass. And the altar in the church was like a stage, lighted from each end. The senses were appealed to by colorfulness, the red and gold of the first church they built that way, the famous Church of Jesus in Rome. Red and gold of the Church of Jesus. And above all, the absence of harsh lines. Everything was luxurious, nothing was harsh. The altar was like a stage. And there was a wide spread place in the church because of the emphasis on preaching. They had two focuses, these churches. One was on the chancel for preaching, and the other was on the altar. But everything with a special lighting effect, not colored, but natural light. And in the Gesù in Rome, which I hope you will see sometime too, in red and gold. It appealed to the senses. The theatrical setting went with the element of exaggeration. And this was, as it were, furthered by the great triumphs of the church. The triumphs of reconquest of Austria and Poland, the conversions in the next century, especially the conversion of the Queen of Sweden, the daughter of Gustavus Adolphus, the savior of Protestantism. We'll come back to Gustavus Adolphus, but the savior of Protestantism in the 30 Years' War. And for the conversion of Queen Christina and her entrance into Rome, part of the city of Rome was rebuilt. The Rome you see today is the Roma Triumphans, the Rome of the triumphant church, the Baroque Rome, the streets, the squares, laid out for processions, laid out for vistas, laid out for grandioseness, laid out for color and for form. This style, this direction of religious fervor, was given a great impetus by the earthquake which shook Rome in 1587. For this earthquake in Rome in 1587, for the first time revealed the catacombs underneath Rome, the famous catacombs of St. Calixtus. Nowadays, if you don't have claustrophobia, which I have, you have to pay entrance to go into them. But in 1587, the catacombs. What are the catacombs? That is where the early Christians had hidden from the Emperor Diocletian. Here were the tombs of the martyrs. Here was an inspiration. For as the Christians had been in Diocletian, so was the Catholic Church in Protestant countries. Not only that, the discovery of the catacombs gave one of the greatest impeti to church building. For as you know, as you don't know, most of you, I'm afraid, the altar of a Catholic church dates back to the tombs in the catacombs. The early Christians performed their services on a tomb in the catacombs when they were being persecuted. And underneath that tomb was some especially worthy person or a saint. That is why every altar in a Catholic church must have a relic of a saint. And so suddenly, there were many relics of saints. And suddenly, and we can make an actual comparison, it was a tremendous outburst of church building, which this discovery of the catacombs again made possible. Now, it is quite true that all this meant Roma triumphants. For example, something that you may have seen, the facade of St. Peter's Cathedral, 69, rather late Baroque, but with its balcony, the center, the whole facade, centered on the appearance of the Pope, the whole making, and the Bernini Square before, in front of it, making a theatrical setting. Above all, what it was meant for, the Easter blessing, when at Easter the church Pope comes out and blesses Orbis et Orbis, the town and the universe. It has all this kind of theatrical setting to it. Now, to be sure, all this could slide into morbidity, especially again in Spain. In Spain with its mysticism. When Philip II built his palace in Spain, the famous Escorial. He built it like a griddle on which St. Lawrence was roasted in 258 in order to remind him constantly of the fate of that saint. To be sure, Pope Innocent VIII slept in his coffin. To be sure, it is now that we get for the first time the kind of pompous funerals in Spain, the cult of corpses, the embalming. All that starts now. All that starts now. And then somehow came to America, I don't know how. But all this dreadful business with corpses starts now as a kind of morbidity into which the Baroque very easily slid. Very easily slid. Thus you might say, and I should add, of course, that black became the color of fashionable circles. Philip II of Spain was never painted anywhere else than in a kind of black, for example. The Baroque, then, is symbolic of what? First of all, it is symbolic of appealing to the senses. It does away with the Renaissance tradition of restraint. It is squarely opposed to the Protestant tradition of moderation, or the Protestant tradition of opposing outward forms. It became, secondly, something that was restless, something that was in motion, and thirdly, it became a deep-set cultural pattern because it fused with popular piety. It reestablished and reinforced, really, popular piety. For the first time now, we get towns and villages keeping what is called miracle books, keeping a record of miracles performed by the local saint. These miracle books, which start in the middle of the 16th century, are of extreme interest for us, because it turns out that these miracles of the local saints were exclusively performed on the upper classes. It is a very good example of that sort of thing. Moreover, it is now that you get this whole thing represented in the screen behind the altar. And I mention this because so many of you go to Latin America and to Mexico, which is entirely Baroque. But if you come into a Mexican church, the first thing you will see is what we call the reredos. It's a Baroque thing, the screen behind the altar, which will visually represent theology, which will visually represent a part of theology, usually in an extremely emotional kind of setting. So that the Baroque became, therefore, a cultural pattern, a way of life, of color, of form, which fits in with popular piety and fits in with the love of the grandiose. It is always said, either you love Florence or you love Rome, either you love the Renaissance or you love the Baroque. Rome is a totally Baroque town. But you can really not love both, and there is a great deal of truth in it. I myself don't like Florence at all. I love Rome, but I am close to popular piety in any case. So, and I'm trying not to overstate the case for it. So what you have here, therefore, then, is this kind of development of a cultural pattern. And it comes together, as it were, with the Jesuit and then the Catholic emphasis on the graduation of sin, the rejection of the Calvinist idea of original sin, the rejection of the Calvinist idea of predestination. But rather, as the greatest Catholic theologian of the age held, a man by the name of Mariana from Spain, as the greatest Catholic theologian held of the age, salvation, he said, salvation, what is it? It is as if two people are pulling a barge ashore, a ship ashore. And that means that you have to pull with God, and that the failings that you have cannot just plunge you into permanent sin. But for those, you can do atonement. Man is always redemptible. Man is always redemptible. And it is the Father Confessor who helps him in this task. Therefore, as there was none of this emphasis on original sin, the kind of Baroque pattern of life became a more light-hearted pattern. The difference I think I say this in the Reformation book too, the difference between the south and the north in Europe is not the climate. If you've ever been in the south, that's not true. And anyhow, I'd trust climatic experiences in history. The difference between the north and the south of Europe is indeed the difference between the Baroque and Protestantism. The difference between this type of life. It's not true that they don't work harder. They just have a more lighthearted attitude towards their work than the North. It's not true necessarily that they are sinful, but they are not self-righteous. All these attitudes which you connect with South versus North in Europe come from the fact that the Baroque penetrated one region and Calvinism penetrated the other. That is really what will make, as you call, lifestyles in Europe. That is what will determine them. Not climate, for example. Not climate, really, but this kind of pattern of life, really lifestyles. It is clear, therefore, that the Reformation is more than just a theological business. That must be clear from the beginning. For theology was a way of life. Theology was a way of life. Well, how can I explain it to you? Yes, the other day a chap came to me and said to me, one hears everything at this university, of course, so nothing astonishes anymore. But he said to me, for example, I love revolution. Through revolution, I relate to people. Through revolution, I get my love and everything. Well, it's a lifestyle with him, obviously. And these are lifestyles, and you cannot break them up into compartments. The final result of the Reformation were lifestyles, which will vastly affect areas of Europe. Because theology is not just a branch, it was life. It gave to people the meaning of life. So do not fall into the trap, and some of you have talked to me, and it's perhaps difficult to you to understand, that this is to the people then, and will remain to the less literate classes until the middle and end of the 19th century, what revolution is to this chap whom I just cited. It is a lifestyle, a way of life. That is why it is sometimes so intractable. Never mind about that. Now it must be clear that the Reformation, the Catholic Reformation, did not remain there. About the Council of Trent, you will read, but there are a few remarks that I want to make about it. The Council of Trent tried to counter the abuses of the Baroque. It tried to counter them. But we must say that in countering the abuses of the Baroque, it wasn't very successful. It tried to counter them. But the most important thing that the Council of Trent ever did had to do with bishops. Had to do with trying to root the church again in its locality, to root it again in the people. And there are two things that they did. One, half-heartedly, and the other, wholeheartedly. The half-heartedly thing is the thing of residency of bishops. Many bishops, as you know, were non-resident bishops. And the Council of Trent wrangled for months about this. In the end, because it was a council of bishops, it did not lay down any rule about that, that bishops must be resident. But it recommended the Pope to see to it that bishops were resident. It sort of, if it were, fudged the issue. But it was quite aware of the issue of the great difficulty of getting the bishops to reside in the provinces and getting them out of Rome. From the bishop's point of view, you can see what was involved. The provinces were very boring. These little dwarf bishoprics everywhere were very boring. And to be in Rome for a bishop was not only not boring, but it also could bring him advancement if he came to the notice of the Pope. But when he was out somewhere in a little province, there he was stuck from his point of view, obviously. So this is the issue on which the Council of Trent nearly floundered. This is the issue on which it nearly broke off. But it did make a kind of compromise under the aegis of the Jesuits. but still more important, and perhaps in the long run the most important thing that the council, well, the second most important thing it did. It provided for a trained ministry. It provided that every bishopric has to have a seminary for priests. Now you will see, so what? But not so what, because up to now the priests weren't trained. Either you went to one of the universities, which was a long and arduous study, to the Sorbonne or another one, a long and arduous study, and most priests didn't take it. You forget sometimes that the parish priest was not trained at all. He was self-trained, at best. So they provided for the first time for a trained ministry for cathedral schools. And that was awfully important for the church, awfully important to get rid of the untrained ministry, of the lack of priests. The lack of priests was one of the things which was most difficult for the church to handle. That must be clear. What then was the most important thing it did? The most important thing the Council of Trent did, of course, was to tighten theology. After the Council of Trent, it was no longer possible to negotiate with Protestants. You could no longer have the indecision that, for example, the Christian humanists had evinced. You could no longer have indecision. The church had come to a decision. And that made an awful lot of difference in the kind of enthusiasm and resurgence that you have in Catholicism from now on for almost a century. Now there is a decision. There is a Catholic dogma, and it is more or less precise. You have a ground to stand on. You have a platform from which to fight Protestantism. And once you got that, the fight was successful. Partly because, I think, this kind of platform, this kind of decision was combined with a capturing of popular piety, with the Baroque, with color and form, with the capturing of popular piety. That kind of combination drove the church forward. So that, while Protestantism is from now in a decline, or it will fight in the religious wars, as you will see, but in the long range, over 100 years, Protestantism is fossilizing. Protestantism isn't going anywhere. It is in fact a decline. In the long view of a century, it is the Catholic Church that surges forward, and surges forward to a spectacular extent. The new enemy was not Protestantism. The new enemy came from somewhere else for the church. For while, as I said, the church had to fight Protestantism and did fight it, the real enemy lay somewhere else. It lay in the new nation states. It lay, after all, in the predominance of the political. That really, that predominance was to be the real new enemy for the Catholic Reformation. Because the nation state was in danger of detaching itself. There was always a danger from now on that religious subversion would no longer be equated with political subversion. And when you come to a time, and it is still a little ahead, when political subversion is no longer equated with religious subversion, what do you then get slipping in by the back door? You get tolerance slipping in by the back door. And then you have a new enemy, not Protestantism, but indifference. Not Protestantism, because tolerance is in effect indifference. You have a new enemy called indifference. You have a new enemy called political priorities. All of this will work itself out in the religious wars. Finally, from the Catholic Reformation then, there emerged, I wouldn't call it a new way of life, but an enhanced way of life of popular piety. There also emerged a new type, a dedicated type, not just in religion, but in secular mode. A dedicated type of counter-revolutionary leader. We shall have occasion but I wish you would do it in your own minds, to contrast a father and son, to contrast Charles V, about whom we will, of course, talk, the emperor, the Erasmian, the Dutchman, in essence, from Holland, the center of the Christian Renaissance, and his son, Philip II, born in Spain, a Spaniard, quite a different kind of type of ruler, quite a different type, quite a different kind of cast of mind. There is, therefore, a different type of ruler which comes to the fore. Now, while all the Reformation was happening, there is, of course, something that we have up to now omitted. There were changes in the political scene. What were these changes in the political scene? First of all, the nation state had arisen and developed. The nation state risen and developed over against the empire. In the age of the Reformation, Europe was still an empire, and an emperor still ruled over most of Europe. But this was destined to change. For the political tension which plays into the revolution, into the Reformation, I must have revolution on my brain too. Around here, that's not difficult. What played into the Reformation was a kind of tension. What sort of tension? And you must be quite explicit about that to understand it. The tension between empire and nation state. I told you before, Lutheranism benefited from the fact that the princes, which were in effect little nation states, could use Lutheranism against the emperor. I told you before that Calvinism benefited from the fact that it could found revolutionary parties within each nation, within each nation state, in this case against both king and emperor. So that you have here a political tension of the kings against the emperor, the nation state against the empire, and eventually groups within the nation state, revolutionary parties inspired by Calvinism, or in the end by Catholicism as well, by the Jesuits as well, because the Jesuits, as you will see, got a doctrine of resistance to authority. The Jesuits were very much in their political theory like the Calvinists. Revolutionary parties within states against both king and emperor. So that the Reformation took place and was partly responsible in a way for a very fluid political situation. A political situation to which we must now address ourselves. And we must address ourselves first to the rise of the nation state, then secondly to the empire, which means to Charles V, though there were three empires. There was the empire of Charles V, there was the equally important Turkish Empire, which went right up to Vienna, and then there was the Empire of Muscovy in the east. Three empires, in a sense, dominated Europe, of which Charles V is only the one immediate concern to us. And then we must address ourselves to the religious wars. For in the religious wars, and please remember some dates here, from 1555 onward, in the religious wars, from 1555 onward, these issues were fought out. These political but also religious issues were fought out in a very kind of revolutionary and dynamic pushing of things ahead, pushing of things ahead into the next century and eventually into our times. So from 1555 it goes on. I must close, however, by making another announcement of sorts about the 6 weeks. And that is this. The learning process is sometimes extremely unpleasant.